Yeah. Hopefully.
Okay, so that's the video?
It's recording.
Got it. Oh, I see. Got it. Okay. All right. Good afternoon. Hope everybody is well. So what I understand is we're supposed to talk about a very relevant and significant and tricky topic of Lashon Hara regarding Shiduchim. It happens to be a pretty big topic, more than you might imagine. So I'll try to lay down some basic concepts, but also certainly an issue which provokes many questions. So we'll try to also balance things so there should be time for questions also. And we'll try to cover as much as we can. First off, so there's a prohibition of Lashon Hara in the Torah. Probably familiar. But its parameters are very hard to determine, and it's also very easily misunderstood and misapplied. And one of the fundamental tensions that occupy all of Hilchos Lashon Hara, that probably is responsible for a very, very significant percentage of the literature, is that there's really a constant tension, because we have a prohibition to speak badly about people. It's the pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, L'osei L'chorachil B'Amecha. There are a number of other sources also in the Chumash and throughout that reiterate this point or restate this point that we're not supposed to speak badly about others. But there is also a crucial value of Toelis, and that we are obligated to speak up if it's going to make a difference. And there's a sefer, Piskei Tshuva on Arachayim. It's not the same Piskei Tshuva on the bottom of the Shulchan Aruch. Is written by one of the Dayanim in Vilna. And he writes there that everybody gets so worked up about what you're not allowed to say, and they don't pay enough attention to the equally important issue of what you're obligated to say. And I always wondered, I don't know exactly how to pin this down. He lived in the late 1800s, so I don't know if he made that statement before or after the Sefer Chavos Chaim was printed. So he said, everyone gets so worked up about what you're not supposed to say. I don't know if he was referring to people being worked up before the Chavos Chaim came out or after the Chavos Chaim came out, but one way or another, he is emphasizing that there are two essentially equally important things here. That, yes, there is a severe prohibition about speaking badly about others when it's not necessary and important. And there is also an imperative to speak when it is going to make a difference. And we generally associate this with the pasuk, Losamar al Dam Riecha, that we're not allowed to stand idly by when someone is at risk. And even though the language al Dam Riecha, so it sounds like it means the risk of someone being murdered, but it's much broader than that. The Rambam understands in Sefer HaMitzvos that it means anybody who's in the path of any kind of danger, whether it's any degree of physical or spiritual or material danger, you're obligated to intervene. So we have this imperative of protecting people from potential harm, and that's Losamar al Dam Riecha. And of course, the idea that not speaking Lashon Hara, Losei L'Chorachil B'Amecha, and also not letting people be harmed, Losamar al Dam Riecha, the idea that they're kind of balanced against each other and seem to be counterweights, is indicated by the fact that these are two halves of the same pasuk. Right? One flows right into the other, the same pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, telling us that, which sounds like that's the message. The Rambam reads it differently, but it sounds like that's possibly the message, that yes, you should not speak badly about others, but you may have to if you have to stand up and do something when there is a risk of harm. So this dynamic makes Lashon Hara complicated. A lot of things makes Lashon Hara complicated. Lashon Hara is always tempting, because it's always a difficult one to begin with, but it's not just about controlling your Yetzirah, but it's also about coming up with the right plan, because it's not clear always what is the right thing to do, and it's not always that there's even a safe side, because the consequences of the wrong decision can be very significant. Saying something that is unfair and can cause harm to somebody is the thrust of that whole prohibition. It could have terrible consequences. But holding back when also you could make a difference in a necessary way and somebody is harmed because you didn't speak up, that also could have terrible consequences. So this is the crux of the complexity not just the Yetzirah, but the genuine complexity for well-meaning people in what to do. And too often, you find that everybody does exactly the wrong thing, meaning that they're very happy to speak Lashon Hara, unless it's important. You know, because if it's going to have a consequence, everyone gets nervous. So they're happy to say whatever negative things are on their minds, unless it's actually going to have an impact. And often it's really the opposite, that when there's going to be an impact, so that's when you have to speak up. And all the other things, that's where the Aveira was. That's where there was a prohibition. So that's in general an unfortunate phenomenon, that people do exactly the opposite of what they should probably be doing in this area. But that's all the more true and all the more intensified in the area of Shiduchim. So in the area of Shiduchim, you have all of the same problems, and this tendency is even more pronounced. So you have people who are very ready to say things that they should not be saying at all, and that actually have a terrible impact without justification, and really constitute, I think, Lashon Hara of the highest order, and we'll try to get to that a little bit. And they have no problem saying those things. That comes very quickly, and they're happy to say the things that are very prohibited under the rubric of Lashon Hara. But if it actually could have a consequence, they don't want to shter a shidduch, so they don't want to say anything when they davka should, when they're actually supposed to. So wouldn't claim that it's easy. It's davka a complicated conundrum that we'll try to shed a little bit of light on. But the unfortunate result is very often you have the exact opposite of what should be. And that's part of what we'll try to bring out, that very often people say things they really should not say and prevent very happy potential shidduchim that could have happened from ever getting off the ground. And that's a tremendous chaval. And very often, terrible suffering takes place because marriages go forward that shouldn't. And people knew things that they didn't say because they were afraid of Shtar Meshurach, they were afraid of Lashon Hara, and that's equally problematic. So this is an area where this tension is felt even more strongly than the whole rest of life. It was complicated enough everywhere else, but in the area of Shidduchim, it takes on a whole extra level of complexity. And there's another reason why, that's almost unique to Shidduchim, but certainly present in Shidduchim that takes on an extra component to it that makes the whole complicated issue even more complicated, just in case it wasn't complicated enough. And that is when you get involved in what you should or shouldn't say regarding Shidduchim, timing becomes crucial. Because there are things, as we'll see, that should be revealed, but should be revealed only within context. And timing makes a big difference. And there are those who deny the significance of timing, but I think that's a very difficult position. I think timing is for sure crucial. And there are things that do need to be discussed and do need to be revealed, but should be revealed at a certain point when there's enough of an ability to see the whole context and to appreciate the individual that you are dealing with. And therefore, that makes a very big difference as far as when this is conveyed. And the poskim have a language, they all have a similar language, that if you reveal something too early, so sometimes that could have a disproportionate negative effect, because at the earlier stages, kol davar katan mekalkel, that any small thing is going to shter it. And if you tell somebody who hasn't yet met the young lady that there's whatever small negative detail, so then he'll say, well, I'm perfect, so why should I go out with anybody who's not perfect? So let's forget it. And if he finds the same information out later on, after he's been able to meet the individual as an individual, as a person, and can see it in the context of everything else, then it takes on a whole different nature. And then, yes, they may need to know this information, but they're able to process that information in the context of who the individual is as a complete person. And that, philosophically, halachically, practically, makes a very big difference. And that's very important. But it's far easier said than said appropriately, because figuring out when that is very, very complicated, especially you're coming as a third party here, let's assume. So there are some things that the parties, and we'll talk more about this in a second, that the parties really should be disclosing themselves. And ideally, if that could happen, that would be the best way for it to take place. But if you don't know if that's going to happen, so then you're going to have to assess whether it's your responsibility or not. And then the timing could really mess things up, because maybe you will say it right before the individual was going to relate in the proper context, and you could do a lot of harm. So it's a scary thing to know exactly how to assess that and when to do it. And I'll also add, just because things aren't complicated enough, to make things even more complicated and to just highlight just how tricky this is. So we know, we try to live by a principle of V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. That's our klal gadol b'Torah. This is our guiding value, that we should treat others as we would want to be treated. But here, there's a quadruple complication. Because, first of all, you're dealing with two parties and their families here, and presumably you have an obligation of V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha to each party equally, even if you feel closer to one, but you're really responsible for the well-being of both of them. So each issue of disclosure or non-disclosure here affects probably inversely either party. So you try to work with the understanding of how can I treat others, how I would want to be treated, but you have two parties who you have that responsibility towards, and you have to keep that in balance. But also, that's just double. Why is it quadruple? Because the assumption that everyone benefits from getting all information is not necessarily true. It relates to what we said before, that certain early stages, cold dove or cut in the calcal. So sometimes if you care about a person, you'll be better serving them if you wait to tell them when it's more able to be seen in a context. And just the fact is that there are many very happily married couples out there that are very, very grateful that they didn't know earlier about a certain quirk of their spouse, because had they found out earlier, they would have refused to go out with them and they would have missed out on their whole happy marriage. So they're happy that they didn't know and that they went ahead with it, and they found out later and they were able to see it in context, and they're very grateful that they didn't get it too early. So trying to think what's the best interest of whoever you're dealing with, so it's complicated. You have an equal obligation to act in the best interest of both parties. And what's in their best interest might sometimes be not to know something too early until they're able to see it in the proper context. So hopefully we have clarified that everything is incredibly unclear, and that gives us a great complexity and challenge, and therefore hopefully we're all appropriately terrified. So far so good? Okay, we're all on the same page? Okay, so now with that, so let's try to establish what some guidelines are or could be. So start off with some of the statements in the Chafetz Chaim, but also, again, just to give context to this. So before we get to the Chafetz Chaim's guidelines, so essentially, really ideally, as we said before, this could happen between the parties, whatever needs to be disclosed. So the young man could tell the young lady and vice versa. And if we had a perfect structure for that, so in some ways that would be the best. And just first to clarify what that obligation is, and how that then translates to a third party, that essentially should emphasize marriage is not a business deal, and we'll say more about that later. But on some level, it is comparable. There are certain elements where there are parallels between marriage and a business transaction. And this is an area in which you can draw upon that parallel, because when it comes to a business transaction, so we know that there has to be complete disclosure about any relevant aspects of what's being transacted. So if I were to sell you something and not reveal to you a flaw in that item, so then that has consequences as far as the transaction is concerned. So that's called the prohibition of onah, essentially that you're going to be misvaluing whatever it is that you're purchasing or selling because of that lack of information. And onah has consequences. So onah, first of all, is an avera. So you're not allowed to conduct a transaction with incomplete information that would make a difference. So there's an isser involved. And if the isser is egregious enough, so then it theoretically undoes the whole transaction. And that's what gets into the halachos of mekach tos, that the transaction actually is considered null and void if it was transacted with a lack of information that would have made a fundamental difference to the one engaging in the transaction. So there is a parallel. Again, I don't want to overstate, and we'll come back to this, I don't want to overstate the parallel between dating and business, marriage and business. But for this purpose, there is a parallel, and that if one were to enter into a marriage with a lack of disclosure about something that is fundamental and important to that other party, so then that would constitute an avera of the type of onah, that would constitute an act of onah, and theoretically it could be severe enough to actually enter into the realm of mekachtos. Now that, I assume, is way outside the scope of what we're supposed to talk about today. That is something of tremendous significance. The possibility of mekachtos in marriage is something that is invoked a lot in the current discussions about the Aguna crisis. Sometimes, usually it's invoked to great controversy because it is a very, very tricky thing to apply, and we won't try to explain that right now because I'm assuming that's outside the scope of what we're talking about, although it is something as smicha students should be aware of because it's certainly relevant. So just to mention this fact that there is sometimes the possibility and suggestion that comes up in a contested divorce situation that maybe there isn't even a need for a get because something was withheld that is so fundamental that it declares the marriage null and void, and when that is actually actionable, so it would mean that marriage could be dissolved without a get and the woman could even marry a kohen, that it's as if the whole thing never happened in the first place. So as you can imagine, the stakes are very, very high. The threshold to reach that level is very, very significant and a matter of tremendous debate among poskim and a matter of tremendous controversy today, because there have been many suggestions, something that I'm sure you've heard Rezhech talk about, he talks about frequently, that there have been efforts in the past few years or decades to assert that in a way that hasn't satisfied most poskim, and so it's a matter of tremendous controversy, but it's actually connected to this whole topic, that there's an obligation of making sure that the parties who enter into a marriage do so knowing what they're getting into, and if there's something that, had they known it, they wouldn't have gotten into the marriage. So certainly it's an avera, and it's an avera that can reach very significant consequences if it's egregious and demonstrable enough. So far so good, everything makes sense? So that's what's at stake here. So therefore, really, the parties have an obligation to each other that if they are going to enter into a marriage, so they have an obligation to make sure they're not conducting that quote-unquote ki'ilu transaction under misleading pretenses, and they have to make sure that the other party knows the information that would have been significant and material enough for them to make a educated decision. So that's an obligation on the one entering into a marriage, and failing to do so is at least a type of onaz, at least a type of oppression and harm to the other party, bringing them into a scenario where they don't have that full awareness. So that's as far as the parties are concerned here. We're talking about the issue of Lashon Hara. So that's where it also creates an obligation on the part of other people, that if you know this is happening, that if you're aware that the situation is that there is a shidduch taking place that is going to bring about such a scenario where one party is going to enter into it not knowing that there is harm that they're going to be walking into, so then that triggers this obligation of Lo Samad Al Dam Riacha. So then you have an obligation as a third party to prevent that harm from happening and to step up and to say something. So here's where, again, the consideration becomes very tricky, because so sometimes there is such a thing and maybe the party knows that they're supposed to disclose it, and maybe they will within the context of that timing. So you as a third party have that tricky consideration to know whether you're coming in too early or whether it will be appropriately dealt with without you. So that's a very tricky consideration. But also a part of it is, and this is something which I think also frames a lot of the decisions, so you have to evaluate the following. So we say, Lo Samad Al Dam Riecha, that you're trying to prevent somebody from being harmed. So what kind of harm are we talking about? So certainly, the most blatant, obvious definition of harm is if somebody is going to enter into a marriage with somebody who's going to harm them, let's say somebody who's actually physically abusive. So that is the most blatant example of Lo Samad Al Dam Riecha. So certainly if you could stop that from happening, if you could say something and prevent somebody from entering into a marriage commitment with somebody who's actually physically dangerous to them, so certainly that's Lo Samad Al Dam Riecha. But we're not assuming that it has to rise only to that level, and we're assuming that there are other forms of harm which also qualify. So let's say if somebody's going to enter into a marriage, it's not physically dangerous, but it's just going to be a miserable marriage. It's going to be something, they're not compatible, and they're not compatible for major reasons, so they're going to have a miserable life. So then presumably that also clearly is also under the heading of Lo Samar Al Dam Riach, and that also requires you to intervene. But we also could then look at other situations. So, okay, so to save somebody from a disastrous marriage, that we understand is within this heading. Although what is and what isn't could be subjective, and that's a part of what we'll see. You know, if we're talking about physical violence, it's not so subjective. We're talking about different levels of incompatibility, that becomes a little bit less clear. And that's something we'll talk a little bit more about. But also, so yes, a marriage, that's certainly a situation of great complexity and challenge if it's not appropriate. But what about before that? So presumably also, you want to, because this affects the question of timing. So if the only concern was that you want to save somebody from a bad marriage, so then you could theoretically wait until the day before the wedding and tell them, by the way, you should just know who this person is, and then you'll let them deal with it then, because they have the ability to cancel the wedding at that point. Now, we all can understand that that's not going to be an ideal situation either, that if everything is in place and they're about to get married the next day, to just tell them this news then, yes, it's much better than the day after, but still certainly not a situation anybody wants to be in. So we could also pull back and understand that you also want to save them from that. You want to save somebody from having to cancel a wedding the day before, after everything emotionally and financially and publicity-wise has advanced to that stage. So then presumably it's not the day before the wedding, it's somewhere before that. So how much before that? So presumably you'd want to tell them before engagement. So a big difference between somebody having to break off an engagement and not get engaged in the first place. So presumably if we're trying to save them harm, so we want to tell them before they make that public commitment. Okay, but fine. But is that late enough? Is that early enough? So if you let somebody go through the however long a relationship takes, and you tell them the day before they're about to get engaged, that also comes after a significant investment of emotion and time. Time is precious, and money and whatever else associated with it. So then also there's still a question, is that early enough to tell them right before engagement? So that's where we start to get subjective, because if you know from the very beginning that there's no question this is a disastrous relationship, it has no possibility of working out, so then, yes, you want to tell them right away, and then there's no factor of waiting. But anything short of that, where there is some possibility that it could be something that could be taken in context, so then the timing becomes complicated. So when exactly do you want to make sure they're able to consider this? It's not the day before the wedding, probably not the day after or the day before engagement. So where exactly is it? That's what gets tricky. And that's where a lot of the subjectivity comes in, especially because there are different paces to relationships among individuals, certainly between communities. So there are some communities where three dates means you're ready, just about to get engaged, and a lot of the literature which comes out of those communities, so you see that as a benchmark, so before three dates, etc. But certainly in other communities, after three dates, you've barely gotten started, so it doesn't necessarily have the same kind of meaning. So trying to put a number on how many dates or exactly where it is becomes very complicated, even though in some of the literature you do see that kind of a framework, but it does require some nuance and some sensitivity to figure out exactly where that point is, where there's enough of a possibility to see the person as an individual and to be able to recognize what their positive qualities are and to see it in the context. And also, it's not that there's been that much of an investment that it's essentially the point of no return. So you want there to be enough exposure, but not so much so that the person really would have wanted to break it off, but they can't because it's too public, there's been too much out there or the like. So that's not fair. So again, it's highly subjective, clearly, but that's essentially the sweet spot or the bittersweet spot that we're aiming for, to try to get to that stage. I'll say personally that my view is that, you know, nowadays there is a whole trend towards asking a lot of questions that are very intrusive, and I can say as a rabbi, I get phone calls from people asking very invasive questions about people and things that I know in confidence, let's say, and I don't necessarily think is relevant to whether it should be given a first date or not, let's say. And there is in general a whole tendency to ask all kinds of questions before a relationship even starts. And we'll talk a little bit more about the details of what's appropriate and what's not. But I mentioned before, v'yahavta l'recha kamocha, so I think as a metric of v'yahavta l'recha kamocha, so let's say you have two people are about to meet, and I guess just could be for either side, but we're talking to a man here, so let's say the man has some kind of issue, which is not his fault, but it's an issue that could impact on the relationship, and could theoretically be seen in context as something workable, but it's certainly something that needs to be disclosed. But the other side wants to know before even meeting. So I understand that desire not to waste any time, and I'm perfect, so I should only go out with perfect people, so tell me right up front whether the person's perfect or not. But separate from what I said before also, but even if it means after two or three dates, they're going to have to break it off. So personally, on that stage, my behalf to loyecha kamocha, my rachmanis is for the first person, because I think everyone should have an opportunity to be seen in totality and in their complete package, especially if it's something that's not their fault, they're not bad people, but there's a situation, whether health-wise or family-wise, that just is a part of their package, and therefore it's complicated. So they have a right to be seen in their totality, and the cost that the other person has that it means is going to be a wasted date or two or three wasted dates or whatever it is. I don't think that's nothing, but I think that it's less than what the other party is giving up if they're never given an opportunity to be seen for who they are. And I think that's a part of a consideration. So in those kind of situations, from the v'ahavta l'recha kamocha consideration, I have more compassion for the person with the issue that they should be given at least two or three dates to give a context in which to be seen, than the right of the other party to have every possible fact up front, that therefore they shouldn't have to waste even one date or one experience on that person, which is not nothing, but still, just in terms of balancing the two, I think that's significant, especially because some of the questions that are asked are matters of confidentiality and not appropriate for someone to just call up a rabbi and say, oh, I heard you have this guy in your shir, tell me, has he ever taken medication? It's not their business, not a proper way to ask questions, and I think you have a right to say you don't know about this. I asked Rav Asher Weiss about this once, and he came to the same understanding. You can't lie to anybody, you can't misrepresent, but he's like, yeah, your information from somewhere else. You know, I don't have the information for you. So I don't know, maybe yes, maybe no. You'll have to find out some other way because I don't have that information for you. Hi, sorry.
And I was going to ask for
examples, but I already gave one. Yeah, I think that's another one. Let's say, you know, somebody takes medication and you think they're a wonderful person and they could have a very happy life and they have tremendous mileage. And for whatever reason, so, and again, I think a person should take medication if that's going to help them. They shouldn't be stigmatized and they're doing the right thing. They're pursuing the path to having a healthy, stable life. So, but there are people who call up and say, I want to know in advance, are they taking any medications? So you may know this in confidence, so it's not even your right to relay that information. And you think that this person is worth meeting. You know, if you know that it's not going to work out at the end, that's a different story, but you think the person is worth meeting. So I think you have a right in that situation to say, I don't know. So you can't mislead them. You shouldn't say, no, I know there's nothing going on, because then that's actually misleading them, and that can come back to cause all kinds of problems later. But if they know they're not getting any information from you, they know they'll have to find it out somewhere else, or they'll have to wait till later to find it out, so then I don't think there's a loss to the other party, and the first party has the ability to be taken as an individual with milas and chesronos like we all have, and that's something which really everyone should be entitled to. And especially when it's not their fault. I mean, it's not that they committed some terrible crime and they're trying to hide it, but there's just a factor of their life circumstance which is complicated, but they're good people, so then they should have an opportunity to be seen in their totality and to be understood. Okay, so far so good? Okay, so what about, so the Chofetz Chaim's points that I was about to get to, so this all comes up, let's say, if you are a third party, and somebody asks you, tell me about so-and-so. Right? I should keep things one kind of, so let's say if we're talking to men, somebody says, tell me about this young lady. So what should you volunteer if you're not asked specific questions? So what kind of things should you volunteer that might be negative? So among the things that the Chofetz Chaim discusses, so he mentions, say, three categories which will relate, and in each of these cases, his example you may or may not relate to, but the point is to extrapolate from the example to categories that we could relate to. So
First off, he says, if there's something that is just an objective, huge issue that most people will see as problematic, so then that for sure you have to volunteer. So that, you know, however you define that, he talks about kfira or about terrible illness, but that for sure you have to come forward and volunteer. Now, illness is highly complicated because there are all kinds of illnesses and all kinds of ways of managing illnesses and all kinds of impacts. So that's a topic where there's an extensive literature about. I'm not going to try to relay all that literature right now because it's very involved and highly complex. But as a general guideline, there are some kind of illnesses which the impact on the marriage is going to be huge, and everyone would certainly need to have that front and center, and the average person would consider it something that they can't proceed without knowing, or they'd be very unlikely to proceed even with knowing. So that for sure you have to disclose. So again, ideally the other party, the dating party, will have an opportunity to disclose it, but if not, then the third party would have to provide that information if they could. And there's a lot that gets much more subjective. So when something is theoretically manageable, sometimes there are conditions that are so manageable that it's possible the spouse could marry them for 40 years and never encounter it. So you have to figure out exactly what kind of category it is. Certainly issues of fertility have a tremendous impact. There's a very notable tshuva of Moshe Feinstein where he draws a distinction between, let's say, a woman who's not capable of having any children and a woman who has a condition which means she'd have fewer children than you might think, but not necessarily zero. And he draws a major distinction between zero and less than one would expect, which is a very interesting distinction, but it also just speaks a little bit to the subjectivity here. So every situation really is unique, and there are all kinds of complicating factors, but these are some of it. What kind of medical conditions would actually impact the other party? Which ones are manageable? Which ones are manageable with difficulty? Which ones are manageable so easily that they may have no impact whatsoever? All of that is a part of that complicated analysis. So the literature about medical conditions is very significant, and it can give you places to look, but I won't try to relay all of it here. But that's the first thing he says, that if there is some kind of a huge issue that every reasonable person would probably consider significant and possibly disqualifying, so that's certainly something that you have to disclose. The party has to disclose, or a third party would have to disclose if the dating individual is not doing so. Another category, and this is really where a lot of the subjectivity is the Chafetz Chaim says that you should not offer, you should not volunteer something which is not objectively bad, but you happen not to like it. It's not something that impresses you as a quality. But the people who are inquiring with you are not asking about that specifically, and therefore it's not your job to volunteer it. So he mentions as an example, he says, let's say the person is not so sophisticated, so he doesn't catch on to people's tricks or people's jokes, he's just not the most sophisticated of people, but he's a good person. But you happen to like people who are a little sharper, a little more sophisticated. So it's not your job to volunteer that information when somebody asks about this guy for a shidduch. So it's not your job to volunteer, yeah, he's not so sophisticated, he doesn't catch on to people's tricks. So that's not necessarily information that you should volunteer if they're not asking about it specifically. So again, you can focus on that example, you can appreciate that example or not, but the category is an important one. Especially because I feel this is where a lot of the problems happen, Bizman has that, that people offer their opinions about things which do not constitute objective facts and can be very harmful. So that's a big problem. That's where I think the Isser of Lashon Hara is very, very present. So if something is not objectively negative or positive and the other people, the inquiring party, did not ask you about it, so for you to volunteer things, that's what the Chafetz Chaim is saying, problematic. So I would put in this category, I know this is a controversial point, but I feel strongly about this, I would put in this category people's assessments of whether it's quote-unquote shayach or not. So people decide on their own whether a couple will get along, whether they'll click, or however you want to phrase it. So I mentioned this in the Beis Medrash a few times, those who were there, that this is the new standard for relationships, but before you get involved, you have the standard of ri'yas ha-chaverim, that do your friends see it or not? That if they don't see it, so then the person doesn't even get a date. And that is a tremendous avala, because no one has the ability to predict whether two people's personalities will click or not. If there's completely incompatible life values, so then okay, so then you can't see them getting along, so then that's something to mention. But just because a person, one's louder, one's more quiet, one's this, one's that, and you can't see it, so that's become a machla in these past few years, that people ask their friends or their friends' wives or their friends' wives' sisters, oh yeah, I met them once, I don't see it, so forget it, and they never meet. So that's a tragedy, because that really has no objective meaning to it. And that's something which can do tremendous harm. People, for whatever reason, they put tremendous faith in their friends' opinions, and they're not necessarily rooted in anything. And I think this is very much in that category of not volunteering something that you don't actually know. And even if they ask you, do you see it? So then the rule is, whatever they ask you, you have to give an honest answer. So what's the honest answer to this question? Honest answer is, I don't know, because you don't know, because you don't have a way really to know, and sometimes there's the Yetzer Hara to sound more knowledgeable than you actually are, and that is the Yetzer Hara, it's not accurate. And if your friend tells you, if you ask them about a relationship, or you ask them about a proposed shidduch, and your friend says, I don't see it, so I think the proper response is, you should ask them, when you don't see it, so does it come to you in a mara? Does it come in a chazon? Is it a naspaklariya hamira, naspaklariya she'ena mira? You know, how exactly was the nevuah transmitted? Because the fact is, it would only be through nevuah that people could come to such a thing. And the proper answer, if they ask you, do you see it or not, is, I don't know. I don't know. Again, if they're completely incompatible, because they know that there are values that are totally at odds with each other, so then, okay, you can't see people getting along, that this one's louder, this one's quieter, this personality, I don't see it. So if you would ask, and I've mentioned this to friends of mine who are in this field, they should conduct a study, it would be a big toelis for the tzibur. If you ask people who are happily married, and by which I mean simply they don't regret who they married, if you ask them how many of them, your friends didn't see it, you didn't see it, you didn't want to do a second date, it's at least 50%. So at least half of the people, their friends never saw it, no one else thought it made sense, and that's just because people can't see such things. So if that's the case, I believe it is, at least 50%, it means instead of asking your friend, you have better odds of flipping a coin. Just flip a coin, don't bother asking your friend, and then see what, make your decision based on the coin, because your odds are better. So the assumption that people know just how, what kind of personalities will connect is a fallacy, and that's not the kind of thing you should be offering, and it's not the kind of questions you should be asking. Now, you can offer it lakula, that if you have, you want to advocate for a relationship and you think that there's basis there that you can imagine people bonding over, so then fine, why not? There's no harm done. But I'm talking about saying in the negative, saying there's nothing that's going to make these two people interested in each other, that's not your job. To mention it, lakula, to say that there's something that you think, oh, this person's considering two possibilities, and this one, I think, there's more that you have in common, so you have a better chance of being interested in this one. That's a reasonable thing to do, and that might make sense. But I'm talking specifically about the negative, about posseling a shidduch, and what we've seen recently is that it's an absolute psul. So you could come with the most highly recommended person who, you know, their family, one of my distinguished colleagues here always points this out, he's a very accomplished shul rabbi, and he says, I've known the family forever, I've known the girl since she was born, and I'm telling you, it's a wonderful person. Yeah, my friends don't see it, so forget it. You know, and it's not just a chizar, it's a psul. So that's a big problem. That's the, definitely, I think that's literally lashon hara. That's saying something that's not actually objective, and that has terrible consequences. And I would put in the same category of actual lashon hara your opinion on the attractiveness of the person. And this is something which is routinely violated, and I think this is lashon hara gemura in the most absolute real sense, that people offer their opinions of whether a person is attractive or not. So first of all, it raises big problems as far as this is concerned, and especially the increasing trend of pictures and pictures that get emailed and sent around and people share them. There's all kinds of certainly sneeze issues of a very significant degree, which is its own area to be concerned about. But also the whole notion of somebody offering his opinion as to whether somebody is attractive or not. So that, I think, is, again, lashon hara gemura, because this is something which is not objective. It's completely subjective. And it really is more subjective than anyone would acknowledge. And for anyone to plant in somebody else's mind the idea that somebody they've never met or seen is not attractive enough for them is something that is not rooted in facts, so certainly eligible for the title of Lashon Hara, but has phenomenal consequences. And you could be depriving this couple of a happy marriage, and could be depriving the person you're talking about of being considered by other people if that kind of thing spreads. And I think it's reasonable to say, Eim l'cha lashon hara gedayla mizu. There's no greater lashon hara than that that could have such a negative impact that's unwarranted. And that's something which you have to be very, very careful about, and unfortunately is very, very routinely violated. Nasta kehater, it's assumed it's kehater, and I think that it's very much the opposite. And yes, of course, those who are learning Daf Yomi and finishing Ksubas now, so you remember the beginning of Ksubas. So there is the notion of Kalanah v'chasuda, which again, like we said before, if you're coming from a positive place and you want to orient people positively, so then that we do find more room for, and maybe that's appropriate. But I think you could also draw a lesson from here, because it's interesting to ask, so why is it that the Gemara highlights that out of all things? So out of all the midos you could be talking about, you could be singing at a wedding. So presumably there are more important things to focus on than whether it's the Kalanah v'chasuda. And out of all the things, Ketzem Ra'aktim Lufnei HaKala, so why do we highlight Kalanah v'chasuda? Why don't we talk about how much of a tzedekah she is, how much of a Talmud Chacham he is? Why don't we talk about these things that presumably are more important to us than physical appearance? And I think the answer is, it ties into this, that this is something which is completely subjective and is created by the image that you create. So if you tell a cousin Kalanah v'chasuda, it becomes a reality. So he feels that she is therefore attractive to him. And there's no chance of your being wrong, because it is subjective by its nature. So if you were to go to a wedding and say, oh, she's a big tzedekah, oh, he's a very honest guy, oh, he never loses his temper. So if you're wrong, you're causing great harm. You're misleading the person, and they're going to suffer because of that misleading information. But if you say Kalanah v'chasuda, there's no chance you're wrong, because by definition it's subjective, and you're able to contribute to that, and you're able to have a positive impact. So therefore I think that's why Chazal zeroed in on that as something which is both risk-free and beneficial, as something you could say. So conversely also, to offer your opinion in the opposite direction is highly damaging. Really, really could have a terrible effect on people and really harm them in very material ways, and has no need to it, has no objection. If somebody asks you again, you can say Kalanah v'chasuda, or you can say, you know, it's all subjective, I don't get involved in these things. But then they have to know that you never get involved, otherwise they'll interpret that as a negative statement. But you know, but to highlight and to help people appreciate that there is a great subjectivity to this, and that it's not up to anyone else's opinion to matter, is something which is important and crucial, and also connects to this whole idea of possible damaging Lashon Hara. And it's also important to appreciate that this kind of Lashon Hara, and when we talk about Kalanah v'chasuda, so the impact you could have is you could stop a shidduch from happening that would have been very good and beneficial for both, so that's certainly one of the risks. But there's also a different kind of delayed effect risk, so that's also important to appreciate. Yeah, and we talk about Kalanah v'chasuda, so it's an interesting discussion, just why that's important. The whole idea of Simchas Chasan Kala is a whole fascinating chesed in general, because most of the chasadim that we have are to help people who are in a bad situation. So you have to visit the sick, and you have to comfort mourners, and you have to feed the hungry. So in general, chasadim are about helping people who are in a bad place and giving them something they need. So the idea of Simchas Chasan Kala, which is included in the realm of chesed, it's the unusual category where somebody should be happy, and so you're helping somebody who's in a good situation. So there's an interesting discussion why it's so important, why exactly it's a chesed. But one of the categories is, and it's something that I think Rav Pam pointed out, that it helps materially. When you say Kalanah v'chasuda, why did Chazal want that? Because it provides a reserve, it provides a buffer, because some weeks or some months or some days after the wedding, So the couple is going to have their first fight, and it's going to start to fray a little bit. It's going to start to weaken the appreciation they have for each other. So therefore, it's important that there be a reserve built up, that just a few weeks ago, a few months ago, the whole chevra was getting around this person and saying, you're the luckiest guy in the world, kalanav chasuda, this is the greatest thing imaginable. So that provides a basis to withstand the harder times, and that's crucial. So that's what Chazal wanted, that there should be this extra reserve built up so that when there's a challenge to the happiness of the marriage, that's going to get you through. But you can also imagine, so inversely, what could happen. And that's indeed what you sometimes find referred to here, that even if you don't stop a shidduch from happening, so you still could have a maybe even worse harmful effect later, because let's say they go through with the marriage and then there's a fight later on, and then one spouse says to the other, "You know, they told me that about you. You know, they said that you're that type of person, or they said that you're whatever," and then it gets much worse. So there's a delayed impact that could happen, and you find this, it's a very demanding standard. I think the Chafetz Chaim says, if I remember correctly, or someone else says this, you know, part of the difficulty in adhering to the standards of the Chafetz Chaim, so you think, okay, so it's hard to be on such a level of Shmiras HaLashon. Chafetz Chaim in Shmiras HaLashon has a whole shmooze there about how no one should think this is impossible, this is the standard everyone can live by. But it's not just that it's hard to refrain when you want to say something, but also sometimes Hilchos Lashon Hara seems to require you to be a little bit of a mind reader, and a little bit of a navi, like I said before, to be able to anticipate what the impact of your words are. So the Sfarim say that if you have something negative to say about somebody in a relationship, but it's not going to stop them from going through with it, they're going to get married no matter what, so then you shouldn't say it. If it's going to make a difference to their decision, so you should say it. But if they're going to go through it anyway, then you shouldn't say it, because of what I was just saying, because then later on they're going to have tensions, and this is going to make the tensions worse, because they'll say, yeah, I remember they told me you were such and such, and they said you weren't so attractive, I realized how unattractive you are. So all of that is going to have a delayed effect, and that's going to be even worse. Now, how to predict that, that's where it takes, again, a level of essentially nevuah that's very challenging, to know what's going to be not enough to stop the marriage from happening, but enough just to weaken the relationship later, that you shouldn't say. That's, again, a challenge that we are daunted by, but that's also a part of it. So in any event, this is the second category, that if there is something that is subjective and they're not asking about, so then you shouldn't volunteer it if you have no basis to assume that this is something that they do care about or something that they would necessarily see the same way that you do. So far, so good. So the third category, the Chafetz Chaim has, again, here the example may or may not resonate, but it's more about the category. He writes that you should not volunteer, say we're talking about a guy in yeshiva, you shouldn't volunteer whether he's a good learner or he's not a good learner, because that she can figure out on her own, because her father can give him a fahir. Father can give him a bechina. So if they cared enough, that's what they'll do. So it's not your job to volunteer that information. Now, sociologically, that may or may not resonate with us anymore. And maybe once upon a time, so that was the understanding, that every girl had a father who can give the guy a fahir. And if he chooses not to, so it means that that's not what they're concerned about. But the principle is something you can extrapolate. Now, of course, what exactly is the goal? That's also something. Let's say they ask you straight out, you know, is the guy a good Talmud Chacham? Is he a good learner? So what exactly they're looking for can be very subjective. Does it mean they want somebody who's going to be Kovei Itim? They want somebody who's bright? They want somebody who's going to be respected by his peers? They want somebody who's going to be a Rosh Hashiva? They want somebody who's going to be a Posek? They want somebody who has Yirah Shamayim? What exactly they're looking for, that question can be very variable. It's also possible that the parents are asking one thing and the girl would be asking something else. So that's also something you have to try to tap into. But the whole question could mean many different things. There's a story, they say, that the Avnei Nezer, as a young man, so he was going out with the daughter of the Baruch Tam. And the Baruch Tam, with Baruch Frankel Tumim, he gave the young Avnei Nezer, he gave him a fahir, and did well, as you'd expect. And then later on, he gave him a second fahir, he gave him a bechina a second time. So the Avnei Nezer then said to him, "Now I've got to give you a bechina." And he gave his potential father-in-law a bechina. So Rav Tam said, well, what's up with that? So he said, well, why did you give me a bechina? So you gave me a faher because there's an idea that you're supposed to marry your daughter off to a Talmud Chacham. So you want to give me a bechina to make sure that I qualify. But there's also an inyan. There's also an inyan you should marry the daughter of a Talmud Chacham. So I have to give you a bechina in order to find out. So how come that's not normally the way it works? How come normally the guy doesn't give the father-in-law a bechina? So because it's a principle of chazaka. We rely on the past. We assume that your father-in-law probably gave you a bechina and his father-in-law went back already, so you already tested at the earlier stage. But you apparently don't believe in chazakas because you gave me a bechina once, now you give me a second bechina. So therefore, apparently you don't believe in chazakas, so therefore I have to give you a bechina too. So the Baruch Tam responded, he said, you're right, you're also very chutzpahdik. So I don't think you should go out with my daughter, and instead the Athanaser married the daughter of the Kotzke Rebbe. Again, that was more of a personality match apparently. But whatever it is, so people are looking for different things, and the whole tradition of bechinas may or may not have a place in our contemporary life, but that question, localizing that question, is important because people could mean all kinds of different things, and answering it, you really have to have a sense of what they're looking for. But especially if somebody just wants to know, is the guy koveitim? Does he take religion seriously? And you don't really care whether he has sharp chidushim that everybody is going to be impressed by. And your response is, well, you know, he's not the top guy in the shir. Then that could create a negative impression, which is irrelevant to the girl. She may not care whether he's the top guy in the shir. She wants to know, is he somebody who's machshav learning? Is he somebody who's going to have a religious household? And so knowing what they're asking when they ask about learning is crucially, crucially important. Or having an appreciation for the nuances in that is crucially important. But separate from that question, what you can derive as a klal from what the Chafetz Chaim is saying is that there are things which are accessible in other ways, and if they care enough, they can find out, and if they didn't pursue that method, so then it's not your job to volunteer it. So if they could have accessed this information easily enough, and they're not taking that path, so then that's not your job to volunteer. So it's a good question, what's included in that category. I would think you could consider this. So sometimes there are things that are easily available on Google. Somebody does a web search, and it's become a normal process that people Google whoever is being suggested to them. So then it's probably not your job to volunteer something that's just out there in such a way that they'll find out anyway, and if they care enough, they could do that. I'm not 100% sure about that, but I think that makes sense. It's probably a reasonable analog to that yisod, that the things that if they go through a normal process they're going to, that people commonly do, they will find out anyway, so it's probably not your job to volunteer that information if they haven't expressed that that's something that they care about. So what about the things that they have expressed? So the Chafetz Chaim writes that any question that they ask, so that's fair game, and then that you have a right to answer, and they have a right to ask as many people as they want, and you have to answer accurately and honestly, and that's fair game. So that, first of all, presents a lumdisha question, because the Sfarim talk about that if the whole yisod of revealing negative information, if the whole yisod is lo samad al dam reyecha, so it shouldn't matter whether they ask or not. It should all be all or nothing. That if there's an issue of lo samad al dam reyecha, then you should have to volunteer it whether or not they ask. And if it doesn't rise to the level of lo samad al dam reyecha, so then it shouldn't matter even if they do ask. If this question doesn't rise to that significance, so the fact that they're asking about it still should be an esser lashon hara. Why does that matter? So there's Sfarim talk about this, and the general approach is that, like we said, there are many different types of los amod. So if somebody, you know, somebody is violent, that's one type. But we said also, just simple incompatibility can also be a reason why you want to save them from an incompatible marriage. And there are certain things you wouldn't know create incompatibility. But then if they say, listen, this is what's important to me, so I want to know about it, so then it becomes los amod. And you find out through that's something they're makbid on, the fact they raise the question. So that's a chiddush to you. So that's why it only comes up once the question is posed. Like we said before, even though the Chafetz Chaim does say you have a right to ask these questions and you have an obligation to answer honestly, so it would say, like I said before, that there are things that are not people's business, or that you know in a way that's confidential and you don't think is going to impact. So like I said before, I think the Eitzah there is to say, I don't know. Now again, not to deceive anyone, but say, you'll have to look elsewhere. I don't have that information. And then they'll know that they don't have it, and maybe they'll realize it's not so significant, or they'll proceed without finding out, and then they'll decide later that that they're happy with it. And I would think that that's the best approach to that. Hi.
So if they do ask you, let's say, see Tom Kalkum, so you would have to answer, but it would be better to just clarify what exactly you're looking for.
Yeah. Right, so you should probably, okay, that is something they certainly have the right to care about. But what people care about in that is 100 different flavors. But it's a good example, what I said before. There might be somebody who's very serious and has kaveh yitun l'torah and is very much a yirei shamayim, but just is not going to impress anybody with his lumdus. So if you volunteer that information that he's not the top guy, he doesn't get the best grades, so then, or he's not making everybody amazed at his kedushim, that might be completely irrelevant to what they're looking for, and that might be something which really could plant a negative impression, which is the chaval guy's a tzaddik gomer, and the guy's a tzaddik gomer, and you're just unnecessarily telling his potential kala that he's not the top guy. It's not important to her. So that's a real thing to think about. Try to figure out what exactly it is that they're asking before you say anything like that. And so that's itself part of it. But let's say if it's something they ask you specifically and it's confidential and it's not really a matter of, you know, there's a great subtlety here, because it could be that, let's say there's something you know in confidence and that you think it's okay to not reveal right now, but ultimately it does have to be revealed as part of the decision-making process. So sometimes it means you should really stay on top of it. But let's say, for example, you have a Talmud who confides in you about something, and the potential spouse, potential dater asks about it, and it's not your place to reveal it, but you know that it has to be revealed, so then you'd have to kind of stay on top of it and say to the guy, listen, you know, I know you told me this, so I'm not going to tell people without your permission, but you do have to disclose it before a commitment, and I'm going to check up on you to make sure that you disclose it, and then if you're not confident that that's happening, then that may trigger a little bit more of a complex situation. But sometimes that's the approach, and you know, to make it clear, you know, once they understand that you're going to check up, so then it's in their interest to make sure it's disclosed through them. But you know, then there may still be a question of whether it's being disclosed accurately. So every situation has its own nuances, and some of those situations can get complicated. So you have to think carefully about how those questions are addressed. Question about that?
I have a different question.
Okay, different question, or should I go on, or different topic? Okay, let's try. Yeah.
Let's say like you're a supervisor and a girl's previously been divorced.
Mm-hmm.
How would you recommend approaching that?
You say the girl's previously been divorced.
Yeah, like she's been married 50 months, it didn't work out, and then you Google her and you found she's been married before.
Right. So that's complicated, because it's greatly complicated, as you can imagine. But there is a legitimacy to finding out something about that, because it could impact the next relationship. But it also, part of the sensitivity has to come to that, is you have to figure out where you can get an accurate picture, because usually it's not going to come from the ex-husband or from the family of the ex-husband, because that's the nature of such things. There's always a lot of subjective negativity that comes. So you know, we know that the situation by its nature is complicated. Occasionally you have a situation where it's totally amicable, and they'll all say that, and then it's a little bit easier, but most often the default is not like that. So it's tricky, because there is a legitimacy to knowing something. You have to know what may impact the next relationship, but you have to try to find a path which is going to be able to separate out the subjectivity and the hurt feelings and the what's going to be relevant. So usually that involves having some trusted third parties who really do have access to what the whole story was, and who can reveal enough of what's relevant to somebody who's considering it. So, you know, very often, let's say if it's an average kind of situation, not super amicable, but not super hostile, terrible stuff kind of thing. So there'll be somebody who's aware and who can say, listen, you know, there's some history there, but it's not necessarily a deal breaker for you. So proceed, and I can find out more later on what's relevant. So to have a third party who might, which will usually be the case, that there might be somebody who is able to be in that position, would probably help. But again, every situation has its own history and its own baggage. Hi.
Given whatever you're saying about the matzah, like people seeing it or not seeing it,
yeah.
Does that mean that any shidduch where the like values match up should be pursued? Are there other
criteria? No, because you also have limited time and limited resources and everything like that. So that's why I say if you have two choices, and there's somebody who one can advocate for positively and say, oh, they have so much in common, I really say, okay, so it makes sense to meet that person first. But to be aware that the fact that somebody just doesn't see the two people clicking, or they're so different personality-wise, I can't imagine them getting along. There are tons of happy marriages like that where people couldn't do it. So to offer that information, yeah, when I say it's a machla, it would be one thing if it wasn't taken as absolutely as it is. But because, unfortunately, people put so much stock in the opinions of their friends, and as a Yetzirah to feel like you know what you're talking about, so people say things they really don't know, so it ends up having a very disproportionate negative effect. So if it was possible to take it in context and you know, say, okay, so I got to choose between this one and that one, you see me getting along with that one? No, not so much, you know, go out with the other one first. You know, then it'd be one thing, but like I mentioned before, there's constant examples of somebody saying, listen, here, this girl has, I've known her since she was born, she's got everything going for her, and well, my friends don't see it, so I'm not even considering it. That's the worst version. Hi.
When answering a question by saying, I don't know, but like the example of someone on Met,
yeah.
Just to clarify, that's not to get out of Sheker, because it's still, it's mitzvah because it's to be
Sheker. Yeah, it's technically false, but it's also, Sheker is also defined to a certain extent by the harm. So, and it's interesting, Bavadji Yosef is quoted in one place as saying, I would not recommend this. I'm not that. So let's say you think something is irrelevant and it's never going to come up. So maybe we should apply Lashanas with Nehashon. And you could actually lie to them because, as the Gemara says, you can say something that's not true with Nehashon. So that, as a matter of policy, is highly dangerous. You know, highly, highly dangerous. First of all, it's just a level of paternalism that's probably too much, right? To say, you know, I can decide for you so much so that I can really mislead you. But also, when it's so often the case, it's going to probably come out, and then the tainus they're going to have on you are going to be tremendous, and justifiably, because you know maybe your whole assessment was wrong. So that's taking on a level of achrayus that is very dangerous. So even if you can make a halachic case for it, it would be highly inadvisable and highly tricky. So if you were just concerned about the issur of shakir, there may even be a basis to actually mislead. Again, not recommended, but if all we cared about was the halacha, then that might even be that far. So here, saying more about getting into a space where you're not likely to actually mislead, and it's technically not true, but it's not true in a way that certainly meets the parameters of Shalom. So that's where I think it's appropriate. Because again, the party doesn't think they have the information. They go, hey, I asked the Rebbe, doesn't know. But I know it could be that maybe he is doing this and didn't tell the Rebbe. So you know, they'll realize they just don't have the answer to that question, and then hopefully the right things will happen, the right things will come about. So that's also a part of it. So in terms of also the question, it's related to the question of divorce, so you also have to recognize that who you ask can sometimes make a big difference. So asking the right person is also a big part of the equation. So first of all, so not necessarily divorce situation. Certainly if you ask an ex-spouse, so you're going to get, you may get information that is very important for you to know. And there may be, depending on the situation, there may be a time for that. Like there may be a time where you need to actually speak to the spouse and get their perspective and evaluate it in that context, knowing that there's probably a lot of slant that could greatly affect things. But just in general, to be aware that there are all kinds of subjectivities that could impact. So it's like perhaps a little bit more common that, let's say, a guy in yeshiva wants to go out with a girl that his friend went out with before. So that is complicated. You ask your friend what he thinks about that girl he went out with. So first of all, maybe it didn't end well for subjective reasons, and you're going to get a very subjective response. Or maybe either, maybe he's hoping to go out with her again, and maybe he's hoping it doesn't work out with you because of that. So you may, for all kinds of reasons, not get a objective answer. And that's important to appreciate, that not everybody is the perfect source, and that that's also a part of the truth of the process, to try to find people who you're asking who really have a sense of what the truth is. And in general, so there is something that's referred to in psychology as the availability bias, that people assume that whatever information they have access to is the best information. And very often, there's no reason to think that. You just happen to have access to this particular source, but it doesn't really give you the best picture. So sometimes you'll ask somebody, okay, so you live in North America, and this girl's from North America, so tell me about her. But, you know, you're the only person you know from North America, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that person really has, there could be others who have a much better sense of who the person is, just because this is the one person you know who has any connection, so I'll turn to them. But you should realize that just because they're most available to you as a source of information doesn't necessarily mean that they're a source of accurate information. And that's also something that has to be considered very carefully. And I had relatives who were in the more yeshivish world, and any time one of their many, many daughters considered a guy in NYU, so they would call me up and say, and I was in college, and say, well, what do you know about this guy? So yeah, just nothing to do with that guy. So I'd say, well, I don't know him so well. You know, so, oh, so he's not such a good guy. I just don't know. You know, the fact that I'm the only guy from NYU who you know doesn't mean that, therefore, this is the perfect source of information about that person. So you should find somebody who actually does know. So that's the availability bias. Okay, this is the one NYU connection I have. I'll ask that person about it, and it doesn't mean that they have any knowledge that's at all helpful to them. And that happens very often. You know, you think, okay, this one connection I can think of, just to appreciate that that also could be misleading, and that's also something to consider. A few more points, but just before we're out of time, just make sure addressing specific questions. So any other questions before I go on? Okay, you know, there's a lot of practicalities that come up, and should emphasize that there is a tremendous subjectivity to this whole process, to any halacha and lashon hara. And I think that's why the whole notion of the Chafetz Chaim Heritage Project and the whole impact of the Sefer Chafetz Chaim had in creating such a focus on this area of halacha, more so than the other mitzvahs of the Torah, is because it's a process that requires really a lot of judgment and a lot of experience and a lot of v'ahavt l'rech kamocha. And there's a lot of very tricky judgment calls, and I think that's a mitzvah in the Torah, of Parshas Kisetzeh, which tells about the obligation to remember Parshas Balozcha, to remember the story of Miriam. And the Ramban writes that's a real mitzvah in the Torah, and the purpose of that mitzvah in the Torah is to keep us away from Lashon Hara. But you could ask, there's a lot of other Aveiros in the Torah, and we don't have a story about everyone who violated each Aveira and a special extra mitzvah to remember the story. So a part of it is, and Rabbi Yitzchak Isaac Sher, who's the Mashkiach in Slabodka, had a sicha about this, that Lashon Hara is uniquely complicated. And you know, if you want to keep kosher, so when you're hungry, you'll check the package for Hashgacha, you'll decide what to do or not. But when it comes to Lashon Hara, if you wait till the moment to try to decide what the right thing is to do, it's very easy to make a mistake, because everything is this careful kind of balance. It takes a lot of thinking and a lot of practicing and a lot of sensitivity developing. So to be reminded of Miriam, this is the Rambam writes in the Mishneh Torah and Hilchos Saras, that you look at Miriam. Miriam had everything going for her. She's a tzaddikas, and she loved the person she was talking about. She helped raise him, and she only wanted to benefit him. And even Miriam could end up tripping over Lashon Hara. So then what hope do the rest of us have? So the hope that we have is we remember Miriam, so we can think about just how tricky it is and recognize it takes a lot of practice and a lot of sensitivity and a lot of questions. So maybe that's why this is an area of halacha which has developed into its own movement, because it takes a lifetime of practice and consideration in order to come to the right decision as far as that's concerned. So that being said, just to say a few extra points. So one other idea that's worth considering is, so we mentioned before that if you were, let's say, focusing on now the person dating himself, so if you have something that would be something about you that would be an issue for the other party and you don't reveal it, so then that could risk gona. And in the most serious instances, that could be a mekach tos. But in a lesser sense, it could certainly be a violation of ona and v'ahavt l'recha kamocha and other kinds of serious averos. But there's a question the Achronim deal with, that let's say it doesn't rise to that level. Right? Let's say it's not the kind of thing that the other party would be a make or break for them. It's not the kind of thing that they would be likely to call off their marriage had they known about. So it doesn't seem like it rises to the level of ona. But in Mekach HaMemkar, we also have a halacha called Gnevas Das. Right? So there, if I sell you something and I misrepresent what it is and I charge you a different price, so that's ono, that's fraud. You're essentially stealing, you're taking money under false pretenses. But let's say you sell something for the correct price, but you still misrepresent it to be more positive than it is. So the purchaser, who would have bought it anyway, is the right price, but the purchaser thinks they're getting a better deal than they actually are. So in reality, they're paying the proper price and they think they're getting a bargain. So that's Gnevas Das. It's not Gnevas Mammon necessarily because the money matches, but it's a problem of Gnevas Das. So some of the Achronim raised the question, so why don't we have a problem of Gnevas Das with Shiduchim also in the same way that even if it's not something that would have made them call off the relationship, but they think they're getting a better deal than they are because, yes, they would have married you anyway, but now they think they're getting a better deal, so isn't that a Gnevas Das? Even if it's not Ona, but it's not Mekach Tos kind of situation, but it is apparently Gnevas Das. So that would lead you to the conclusion that maybe you should be obligated to disclose everything. And you should mention that on your third grade math test, you didn't do so well. And when you were 12, you missed Tzman Kriya Shema. So like, how come you don't have to disclose everything? You know, even if it's not the kind of thing that would have made them call it off. So maybe there's an issue of Gnevas Das. You're presenting yourself as perfect, and you're only 99% perfect. So why don't we say if there's any degree of difference, so it's an issue of Gnevas Das, you should have to disclose everything. So, spoiler alert, do not disclose everything, you'll never get married. But that's possibly a part of it. So the Achronim addressed this question. There's a different Malkiel about it. Others talk about the Stipler in Yevamos has a few Mahalchim about this question. And there's also a Tshuva about it in the Tshuvas Divrei Yatziv, the Klausenberger Rebbe. So the Klausenberger Rebbe writes that he thinks it's basically a Takanas Hashok, that, like we said before, that if everyone would disclose everything, so then they're never going to get married, and people want to get married, so they don't want to have the other party tell them every little detail and clogging up the whole process that way. And like we said at the outset, there are things that people are very happy not to be told about so that they can have a whole happy marriage afterwards and not be distracted by that irrelevant information. So you could say, essentially, it's like a Takanas HaShuk, that theoretically there should be an obligation of complete, absolute disclosure, but nobody's interested in that. It's not to the benefit of either party, so therefore everyone enters into this process understanding that if there's something that's not going to affect my decision of whether to go ahead with this, so then I'm not looking for you to disclose it, and there's no Gnevas Das as far as that's concerned. That's one approach. The Stipler has a little bit differently, has a few mahalchim there, but one approach he has is, you could say like this, let's say, to talk about the Gnevas Das and Mekach HaMemkar example, so let's say I sell you a car, and I tell you that the car, you should just know, it also has Wayu Torah comes out of it automatically as soon as you turn the car on. So you would have bought the car anyway, it was the right price. But then as you drive home, you realize that that part isn't there. There's no, it doesn't have the automatic Wayu Torah feature. So, okay, so you would have bought it anyway. You know, there's no Ona there. There's no Mekach Tos. But okay, you thought it had this feature. It didn't. That's fine. You're not going to come and complain because it was the right price. But then, let's say I call you the next day and I say, listen, I feel bad. I sold you the car yesterday and I told you it has the Wayu Torah feature. So I have a different car with the exact same model that does have the Wayu Torah feature. So I'll be happy to drive it over to your house and trade. So would you accept the trade? Yeah, presumably. Why not? Okay, so I wouldn't have complained about it, but I'll take the version that has the perfect feature to it. So now let's try to carry that muscle over to marriage. So let's say you get married. Shadchan tells you about somebody. You're happy, you get married, and over the course of that marriage, you realize there are certain quirks you didn't know about, but it doesn't matter because you're happy, and you're happy you didn't know about the quirks beforehand, and fine. So you're having your 20th anniversary, and then after your 20th anniversary, the shotgun called and says, listen, I feel bad. I suggested this girl to you, and I didn't tell you about this quirk, but I have another woman who's exactly the same as your wife, but she doesn't have this quirk. So what would you say? You want to trade? You want to divorce her and marry her? So what's the right answer to that question? Right? So you might think the right answer to that question is no. But no, that's not the right answer. The right answer is it's a ridiculous example. There's no such thing, right? It doesn't work because the whole question is crazy, because the whole scenario is crazy, because human beings just don't work like that. Human beings aren't exactly the same, but with one detail that you could change. And it's never going to come up that, oh, there are two exactly the same people, but one person has this quirk and one doesn't, so you could switch out one for the other. The same way the car, the whole example doesn't make sense. So the point is that to a certain extent, there is a parallelism between Mekach u'Memkar and marriage, but you can't take it too far. It does break down at a certain level. And using that example of Gneivas Das that would apply in Mekach u'Memkar is not going to translate the same way to marriage. Human beings are each unique individuals, and people relate to them that way, and it's not the same kind of expectation of perfection. The whole concept of perfection doesn't make sense in the same way, and therefore the whole comparison breaks down. So what's the Mussar Haskel of both of these answers is to recognize that there's a delicate balance here, that there is a certain parallelism between business and marriage, and for certain purposes they do have overlapping concepts. They both involve a interaction between people that involves a commitment that requires open honesty between the parties and proper concern for what the others care about, and that failure to take that into account and to disclose that could be invalidating and certainly would be morally wrong and could be invalidating as well. So to that extent, yes, there is some kind of a comparison between the business world and dating. But the upshot of these points of the Divrei Yatziv and the Stipler is that to have too much of a business-like attitude towards it, so first of all, to come too much with a checklist that's got to be exactly that, that is a recipe for failure. Like the Divrei Yatziv says, you're never going to get married that way. It's not a productive way to go about things. And to see it as merchandise and to see the relationship as a product that you buy from a store that you could trade in for a better one, you could trade in for a perfect one. So that's also a very dangerous way of thinking that's not going to be a recipe for happiness. So these are some of the lessons that emerged. I recognize that this is a certain level of comparison between those two fields, but one should not get carried away by seeing that comparison as too absolute or as too matched, and to recognize that there is the yesod of v'ahavta l'recha kamocha that is at the core of everything, and to understand that we want to allow people to come into relationships that are going to be beneficial, and that means sometimes saying what needs to be said. Equally often it means not saying things that are irrelevant, and that our society, we've seen the Yetzirah is very much in both directions, and that very often situations that are disastrous have been allowed to happen even though people could have stopped them, and that is terrible. And that has, and I should just mention this also on that side, that if you're worried about Lashon Hara, so then here it's actually the same Aveira. So it's not just like the Pesachei Shuvah was saying, you should worry about Toelis as much as Lashon Hara. You should worry about Lashon Hara as much as Lashon Hara, because if you don't reveal something in a timely fashion, and then that ends up to be a bad marriage. So, Ein l'cha lashon hara gedola mizu. There's no bigger. Another example. There's no bigger lashon hara crisis than when a whole community now has to get involved in taking sides between different spouses because the marriage didn't work out, and there's all kind. And let's say there's a get situation, so then everyone has to get involved, and there's a whole thing. So, if you're worried about lashon hara, so that's huge lashon hara. So, better a little bit of disclosure early. And to avoid that kind of Lashon Hara that could happen later, is even if that was the only Avera you cared about, still, just from a cheshbon of Lashon Hara, it gets much, much worse if it's not addressed in a timely fashion. So to have an appreciation for the considerations on all these factors is a very, very delicate process, and we should all be zocheh that with the right intentions, it should bring about the right results, and that should be both for our souls and for our friends and for our family members, and we should see only simcha and nachas with all the proper efforts. Okay, yashar koach. Should be only good thing.